Chapter 5. The interior of the Emerald Dolphin was disintegrating, bulkhead toppling against bulkhead, deck falling on deck. In less than 2 hours after it had burst into flames, the ship's grand interior had been consumed. The entire superstructure was collapsing into a fiery hell pit. The ornate decor, the elegant shopping avenue with its stylish shops, the $78 million art collection, the lavish casino, dining rooms and lounges, the luxurious staterooms and opulent entertainment and sporting facilities, all had been reduced to smoldering ashes. Everyone crowded on the open decks of the Deep Encounter, former passengers and crew, the men and women working feverishly on the Numa survey ship, all stopped whatever they were doing and gazed at the Holocaust with a mixture of grief and fascination as Captain Birch steered around the stern of the gigantic ship toward the bow. No longer a ball of raging flame, she was melting down into a dying furnace. The frenzied fire having attacked and consumed every flammable material, every combustible object, now found nothing left to destroy. The fiberglass hull lifeboats hung grotesquely and contorted, having melted into unrecognizable shapes. The great circular decks were drooping down around the hull like the decayed wings of a dead vulture. The high observation lounge and most of the bridge had fallen inward and all but disappeared, as if swallowed in an immense chasm. Much of the glass that had melted was cooling and re-hardening into unnatural configurations. Consumed by the Holocaust, the entire circular superstructure caved in upon itself under a great billowing pall of smoke. Fresh flames suddenly leaped through the open sides of the hull from explosions deep below. The Emerald Dolphin shuddered like a great, tortured beast. Yet she refused to die and slip beneath the waves. She drifted doggedly on a sea that was turning gray and nastier by the minute. Soon she would be little more than a gutted hulk. Never again would she hear the footsteps, conversation, and laughter of cheerful and excited passengers. Never would she majestically sail into exotic ports throughout the world as proud a ship as ever sailed the seas. If she remained afloat after the fires cooled and her hull plates did not buckle from the intense heat, she would be towed to her final harbor and a shipyard, where she would be cut down into scrap. Pitt stared at her with deep sadness, watching a fabulous ship reduced to a ruin. He could feel the heat of the flames reach across the water and touch him. He wondered why such beautiful vessels had to die, why some sailed the oceans for 30 years without incident before heading for the scrappers, while others, like the Titanic on her maiden voyage or the Emerald Dolphin on hers, came to early grief. There were lucky ships, and there were those that sailed into oblivion. He stood hunched over the rail, lost in his thoughts, when McFerrin came and stood next to him. The cruise ship's second officer remained strangely silent as the Deep Encounter moved slowly past the macabre drama. The rescue boats, with their overloaded cargo of survivors, followed in the wake. "How are your hands?" asked Pitt solicitously. McFerrin held them up and displayed bandages that looked like white mittens. His face, with burned and reddened skin, was smeared with antiseptic lotion and looked like an unsightly Halloween mask. "Not easy going to the bathroom, let me tell you." Pitt smiled. "I can imagine." McFerrin, on the verge of tearful rage, gazed entranced at the ghastly sepulcher. "It should never have happened," he said, his voice quavering with emotion. "What do you think caused it?" McFerrin turned from the glowing, twisted hulk, his face strained in anger. "It was not an act of God, I can tell you that." "You think it was terrorism?" Pitt asked incredulously. "There is no doubt in my mind. Fire spread too quickly for it to have been accidental. None of the automated fire warning or fire control systems went into operation. And when they were manually engaged, they refused to function." What mystifies me is why your captain failed to send off a distress signal. We turned toward you only after we saw the glow of your fire on the horizon. Our radio inquiries regarding your situation went unanswered. First Officer Sheffield. McFerrin fairly spat out the name. He was incapable of command decisions. When I found that no message had been sent, I immediately contacted the radio room, but it was too late. The fire had already reached it and the operators had fled. Pitt gestured up at the high angled bow of the cruise ship. I see life up there. A large group of human figures could be seen waving excitedly on the forepeak of the ship. Unlike those who had run for the stern, 50 or more passengers and large numbers of the crew had made their way to the open forepeak above the bow. Fortunately for them, the bow was a good 200 feet away from the forward bulkheads of the superstructure and upwind from the fire and acrid smoke that had streaked toward the stern. McFerrin straightened, held a hand over his eyes to shield them from the rising sun, and peered up at the tiny figures wildly gesturing above the bow. Mostly crew, with a sprinkling of passengers. Actually, they looked like they might be okay for a little while. The fire's going the other way. Pitt took a pair of binoculars and scanned the waters around the bow. None appear to have jumped. I see no sign of floating bodies or swimmers. So long as they're safe from the fire for the moment, said Birch, approaching from inside the pilot house, it's better we leave them until another ship arrives or the weather settles down. It's obvious we can't stay afloat in rough seas with another 400 people on board, Pitt agreed. We're just a hair away from capsizing and sinking as it is. The wind was beginning to fling itself at them, rising from 10 miles an hour to 30. The sea was tossing white-capped foam in the breeze, and the swells came marching in like an irresistible force, now rising nearly 10 feet high. It was only a warning of the fury that was yet to come. Pitt rushed off the bridge and shouted for the crew and scientists to get as many people as possible off the work deck and to secure those who were left before the waves smashed over the sides and swept them away. The crush on the lower decks was quickly becoming unbearable, but there was no alternative. To leave hundreds of people exposed to the elements during a tempest would be signing their death warrants. Pitt studied the crews of the two boats trailing in the wake. He was gravely concerned about their situation. The sea was too chaotic for them to come alongside and unload their passengers. Pitt looked at Birch. I suggest, Skipper, that we turn and come around on the lee side of the cruise ship and use her for a shelter from the storm's battering. If we can't get the boat crews and the survivors on board, we've got to move them to calmer water in the next few minutes or it will be too late for them. Birch nodded. A sound recommendation. It may be our only salvation as well. Can't you bring them on board? Asked McFerrin. Another 100 people on this vessel will be the straw that broke the camel's back, said Birch, soberly. McFerrin looked at him. We can't play God. The expression on Birch's face was one of torment. We can if it means the lives of all the passengers already aboard. I agree. Pitt said, firmly. They're better off sheltered from the worst of the storm on the Emerald Dolphin than coming on board the Deep Encounter. Birch stared down at the deck for several moments, considering every option. Finally, he nodded wearily. We'll keep the boats tied close to our stern in case their situation becomes critical and they have to come on board. Then he turned and looked at the wall of dark clouds that were rushing across the water like a thick swarm of locusts. I can only hope God gives us a fighting chance. The storm roared toward the little ship and its mass of humanity. Another few minutes and it would enshroud them. The sun had long disappeared, taking any hint of blue sky. The crest of the waves swirled like dervishes and threw off billows of froth and spray. Warm green water sloshed over the work deck, drenching those who were unable to find room below. As many as humanly possible had been shoved through the hatches, jammed into the passageways like commuters on a rush hour bus. Pulled close to the burning ship, those in the boats suffered more from the heat that radiated from the fire then from the wind and waves that tossed them about the stormy sea. Both Pitt and Birch kept a sharp eye on their condition, ready to haul them on board at the first sign of trouble. If help did not come quickly and the Deep Encounter sank, taking its precious cargo with her, there would be few survivors. "Do you know if anyone up there has a radio?" Pitt asked McFerrin. "All officers carry portable radios." "Their frequency?" 22. Pitt held the radio close to his mouth and covered it with one side of his coat to cut down the sound of the wind that was building to a howl. "Emerald Dolphin, this is Deep Encounter. Is there an officer on board who can read me? Over." He repeated the request three times through heavy static before a voice came back.
"I hear you, Deep Encounter," a woman's voice replied. "Not well, but enough to understand you."
"I have a woman," said Pitt, looking at McFerrin.
"It sounds like Amelia May, our chief purser."
"The fire's causing interference. I can barely make her out."
"Ask how many people are on the forepeak," ordered Birch.
"Am I speaking to Amelia May?" Pitt inquired.
"Yes. How do you know my name?"
"Your second officer is standing beside me."
"Charles McFerrin?" she exclaimed. "Praise God, I thought Charlie died in the fire.
Can you estimate the number of passengers and crew left on board?"
My best guess is 450 crew with about 60 passengers. When can we begin to abandon the ship?"
Birch was looking up at the bow with an intense look of dismay.
"No way we can take them aboard," he said again, with a sad shake of his head.
"Either way you look at it," said Pitt, "it's a no-win situation. The wind and sea are rising at an alarming rate. Our boats can't pick them up, and it would be suicide for them to jump into the water and attempt to swim to our ship."
Birch nodded in agreement.
"Our only hope is for the British container ship to get here in the next half hour. After that, we're in God's hands."
"Ms. May," called Pitt, "please listen to me. Our ship is loaded far beyond capacity. We are also in danger of sinking due to a crushed hull. You must hold out until the weather slackens or a rescue ship arrives. Do you understand?"
"Yes, I understand," she echoed.
"The wind is blowing the fire aft, and the heat is not unbearable."
"Not for long," Pitt warned her. "The Dolphin is swinging around and will begin drifting broadside against the wind and current. The fire and smoke will move closer and pour off to your starboard."
There was a pause, then Amelia said resolutely, "I guess we'll have to break out the marshmallows."
Pitt looked up to the bow, squinting against the spray thrown by the wind.
"You're a very intrepid lady. I hope we can meet when this is over.
Dinner's on me."
"Maybe." There was a hesitation.
"You'll have to tell me your name first."
"My name is Dirk Pitt."
"A strong name. I like that."
"Over and out."
McFerrin grinned wearily. "She's a gorgeous creature, Pitt, and quite independent when it comes to men."
Pitt grinned back.
"I wouldn't want it any other way." The rains came like a glistening, solid wall, not gradually, but in a sudden deluge. And still, the Emerald Dolphin burned. Her sides were glowing red as the rain struck the ferocious heat, quickly covering the flaming ship in a vast cloud of steam.
"Bring her within 200 feet of the hull, slow and easy," Birch ordered the helmsman.
He was troubled at the pitching and rolling of his ship as she was pounded by the rising waves. He became even more troubled when Chief Engineer House called the bridge.
"The old girl is being hammered down here," he reported. "The leaks are getting worse. I can't guarantee how much longer the pumps can keep up, even with the auxiliaries adding to the discharge."
"We've come under the hull of the cruise ship," replied Birch. "I'm hoping her bulk will protect us from the worst of the storm."
"Every little bit helps."
"Do the best you can."
"It's not easy," grumbled House. "Not when you're climbing over bodies packed tighter than an anchovy jar."
Birch turned to Pitt, who was peering into the wet gloom with the binoculars.
"Any sign of the container ship or the Aussie frigate?" The heavy rain has cut visibility to a bare minimum, but radar has the container ship closing within 1,000 yards. Birch took out an old bandana and wiped the moisture from his brow and neck. I hope the captain is a good seaman, because he's going to need all the experience he's got.
Captain Malcolm Nevins, master of the Collins and West Shipping Line's container ship Earl of Waddlesfield, sat in an elevated swivel chair with his feet propped on the bridge counter and contemplated the radar screen. Just 10 minutes earlier, the burning ship was in visual contact, but then the storm closed in with phenomenal swiftness, and the accompanying deluge had curtained off all view. With an air of practiced indifference, he eased a platinum cigarette case from his pants pocket, lifted out a Dunhill and placed it between his lips. Incongruously, he lit the expensive cigarette with an old, scratched, and dented Zippo lighter that he had carried since serving in the Royal Navy during the War of the Falklands. Nevins's ruddy features, usually humorous and pleated, were set in concentration, his limpid gray eyes squinting and uneasy. He wondered what kind of hell he was about to find. The radio reports from the American survey vessel were morbid with descriptions of over 2,000 people trying to escape the blazing cruise ship. In all his 30 years at sea, he could not recall a disaster of such magnitude.
"There!" shouted his first officer, Arthur Thorndike, pointing ahead off the starboard bow through the bridge windshield.
The falling sheets of rain parted for a minute as though they were drapes, revealing the blazing cruise ship enshrouded by smoke and steam.
"Engines on slow," Nevins ordered.
"Aye, sir."
"Are the boat crews standing by?" asked Nevins as the huge liner materialized out of the downpour.
"Boat crews standing by and ready to lower away," answered Thorndike.
"I must say, I don't envy them floating on a sea with 12-foot swells."
"We'll lay to as close as we can to save them time and distance between ships."
He picked up a pair of binoculars and peered at the water around the cruise ship.
"I don't see anyone swimming, and there is no sign of lifeboats."
Thorndike nodded at the torched remains of the ship's lifeboats.
"Nobody left the ship in those."
Nevins stiffened, his mind picturing a blazing hulk carrying thousands of dead.
"The loss of life must be horrendous," he said darkly.
"I don't see the American survey vessel."
Nevins read the situation instantly.
"Come around the ship. The Americans must be on a sheltered side." The Earl of Waddlesfield lumbered steadily through the chaotic waters, as if disregarding all dire threats from the sea and daring the elements to throw their best at her. At 68,000 tons, she was more than a city block long, and her decks were piled several stories high with boxed units filled with freight. For 10 years, she had sailed every ocean in the world through every kind of sea without losing one container or one life. She was considered a lucky ship, especially by her owners, who had profited millions of pounds from her reliable service. After this day, she would become as famous as the Carpathia, the ship that had rescued the Titanic survivors. The wind was approaching gale force and the waves became steeper, but they had little effect on the big container ship. Nevins had little hope of rescuing any passengers or crew. Those who had escaped burning to death, he thought, had jumped overboard and had surely drowned in the turbulent waters by now. As the Earl of Waddlesfield slowly rounded the high, sloping bow, he stared up at the raised, green-painted letters, Emerald Dolphin. He felt despondent as he remembered seeing the beautiful cruise ship as she'd left port in Sydney. Then, abruptly, he was staring disbelievingly at an entirely unexpected spectacle. The deep encounter was rolling heavily in waters reflecting the orange flames, her hull sunk almost to the gunwales, her decks overflowing with huddled figures. No more than 20 yards behind her stern, 2 launches bobbed up and down, their interiors also filled with human bodies. The ship looked as if she was about to plunge under the sea at any moment.
"Good Lord," muttered Thorndike. "She looks like she's sinking."
The radio operator leaned from the radio room.
Sir, I have someone on the American ship. Put them on the speaker.
Within seconds, a voice boomed through the amplifiers. To the captain and crew of the container ship, are we ever glad to see you. This is Captain Nevins. Am I speaking to the ship's captain?
No. Captain Birch is down in the engine room, examining the water flooding the ship.
Then who are you?
Dirk Pitt, Special Projects Director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency.
What is your condition? You look like you were foundering.
We're close to it, Pitt answered candidly. We knocked in our hull plates when we tied to the cruise ship's stern to rescue her crew and passengers. We're taking on water faster than the pumps can handle it.
How many survivors do you have on board? Asked Nevins, still astounded at the number of people struggling on the work deck to keep from being swept overboard.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,900, with another 100 still in the boats.
My word. Nevins' voice was slow, stunned, almost a whisper. Are you saying that you've rescued 2,000 survivors?
Give or take 50 here and there.
Where in the world have you put them?
You'd have to come over and see for yourself, said Pitt.
No wonder you look like a goose who swallowed a barbell, Nevins muttered in wonderment.
There are still close to 500 crew and passengers waiting to be rescued on the forepeak of the cruise ship. We simply could not take them all without endangering everyone's life.
Any chance they may be burned?
We're in contact with the ship's officers, and they report that they're in no immediate peril, explained Pitt. I respectfully suggest, Captain, that our first priority be to transport as many people as possible from our ship to yours while we're still afloat. We'd be grateful if you took those in our rescue boats on board first. They're having the worst of it.
We will indeed. I'll lower my boats and begin ferrying the survivors on your vessel to mine. We certainly have more room for them over here. Once your boats are unloaded, that will leave them free to take on those still on the cruise ship's bow who can lower themselves down on ropes.
We have the routine down to a science by now.
Then we had best get to it.
Then Pitt added, Believe me, Captain Nevins, you'll never know what a blessing your timely arrival is.
I'm thankful we were in the neighborhood.
Nevins turned to Thorndyke, his normally humorous expression incredulous.
It's a miracle they put all those people on such a small ship.
A miracle it is, murmured Thorndyke, equally astonished.
To paraphrase Churchill, never have so many been saved by so few.